Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the oil crash and you when we come back. Stand by. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage here in America. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. And the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. My God, that sounds like a rebel, doesn't it? Well, I wished I'd have thought of that statement myself, but that quotation didn't come from some rebel or hippie. It came from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. Not the political process. Certainly doesn't come from politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats, does it? You know, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call me here at the law school? It's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org and click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, the oil crash in you. That's what we were talking about last time. I got a letter here from a fellow named Tate. Took me to task a little bit, and he said, you know, I don't think that you've got all the straight dope. I said that there's a trillion barrels of oil. Now, if you take world consumption at about 20 billion barrels a year and divide that into 1,000, that's 1,000 billion equals a trillion. So divide that by 20, it gives you about a 50-year supply. So, you know, the world's not running out of oil today, tomorrow, or next week, but in 50 years, we're going to consume that trillion barrels of oil. Now, a trillion barrels of oil is about the size of a lake, the size of Lake Nasser in Egypt. I think I calculated this out. And you take Lake Mead near Las Vegas, you know, there at Hoover Dam, I think it takes three of those Lake Meads to make one Nasser lake, or to make a trillion barrels. That's a lot of oil, isn't it? And we're going to burn that up in the next 50 years. Now, that's a bunch of oil, I'd say. And we're going to need another trillion. So you got to go out and you've got to explore for this oil and find more and more. And they find that we're out looking for it. But the only people looking for oil today are the big multinational oil companies. The thousands and tens of thousands of little guys that used to look for oil, called wildcatters here in the United States, they're out of the game. They were put out of the game by the environmentalists, the government, and the multinational oil companies. Now, I don't know how much oil there is to find in the world, but my guess would be that it's probably 2, 3, or 5 times the amount of oil that we know about, because the big oil companies are not looking for little oil finds. They're only looking for big oil finds, because that's where the money's at. Now, I had a student come in here one time, and he owns some stock, or he owns some oil wells down in Texas. And what happened was the Chevron company sold this oil field off because it doesn't produce enough oil for them. Now, it's producing oil, and it's producing a lot of oil and making this guy very, very wealthy, and he's happy as a clam at high tide. And he and probably 15 or 20 other investors own this oil field. Maybe it produces 1,000 or 10,000 barrels a day or something. But the big oil companies, listen, they want wells that produce 15,000 barrels a day. When Standard Oil goes out looking for oil, if this thing doesn't produce 15,000 barrels a day, they're not going to look at it. They won't talk to you about it. When they drill a drilling platform out in the Gulf of Mexico, they're not looking for 100 barrels a day or 1,000 barrels. They're looking for 15,000 barrels a day per well. And off of those platforms, they can poke 4, 5, or 6 holes in the ground. So they're looking for big money, and they don't want competition. I mean, you know, look at it from the point of view of the oil industry. Why in the world would the oil industry want 1,000 little guys like George Gordon out here poking holes in the ground and coming up with 100 barrels of oil out of each one of those holes and putting that oil out in the market and depressing the price? And after all, the more oil there is out there, the lower the price. So in order for us to maintain higher prices, then we got to have less of the product. So we got to have fewer players in the game. And it's easier for 10 or 15 multinational oil companies to control the price of oil than it is to have 10,000 little guys that are out here poking holes in the ground. I mean, it's just business, just where reality is located. So the big oil companies go to the government and they get the governments to pass regulations. And these regulations, of course, the big oil companies have to meet these regulations. Well, okay, well, Standard Oil has got $5 million or $10 million to do an environmental impact statement to satisfy the EPA and to satisfy the greenies and all the ecologists. But George Gordon can't do that. So I'm locked out. I can't go into the oil business. And as a result of that, there's a lot of oil that we would be finding in little pools all over the world, all over the United States, if we could drill. But we can't drill. So this is why I've mentioned before that we have an artificial oil peak coming. It's being manufactured. It's being manufactured. Nobody knows how much oil is in the Earth's crust. It could well be that there is more oil in the Earth's crust in little pools of 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 300,000 barrels than there is in, 6 billion barrel oil finds, like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And, you know, the environmentalists complain, gee, there's only 6 billion barrels there. 6 billion barrels. Let's see how much that is. That's 6,000 times 50 is 300,000 million dollars, 300,000 million, 300,000 million. Well, 1,000, excuse me, 300,000 billion. The 300,000 billion is $300 trillion, isn't it? Or is that 3 trillion? Maybe it's $3 trillion. I have to sit here and work out my zeros a little bit. But, you know, $3 trillion, $50 a barrel times 3,000 million is $3 trillion, not 300, it's $3 trillion worth of oil at $50 a barrel. Seems like a lot of oil to me. That's 1/3 of the total gross domestic product of the United States, adjusted for borrowing. Seems like to me that that would be worth going after. That's a year's worth of oil here for the United States, rather than to import that oil from overseas and pay $3 trillion to foreign governments around the world and add that to our balance of payments deficit, don't you think? Well, here's the difficulty of adapting to this whole new, the oil crash new concept. The major part of the problem is that existing equipment is designed only for oil fuels. For example, the world's 11,000 airliners cannot run on natural gas, nuclear, or coal. And byproducts of oil, the cost and decreasing availability of 500,000 known uses of oil, fertilizers and farms and food supply and medicines, plastics, insulation, computers, asphalt, inks and toners, paints, glues, solvents, antiseptics, golf balls, CDs, trash bags, nail polish, detergents, chewing gum, so on. 500,000 known uses for this oil. And there's a hidden problem. Not only will the oil supply dwindle, but the shortages and climbing prices will obstruct industry as it attempts to convert society to other forms of energy. Proof of impending shortages. Much uninformed literature says oil is plentiful and that better extraction will maintain adequate supply for decades to come. However, this sheet reveals 1, misleading reporting of oil inventories by oil extracting countries, and 2, a clear 40-year trend of less and less discovery of oil and dwindling outputs from the steadily emptying wells. All right, so now that's a problem, and I look at that just like standing on the decks of the Titanic and somebody says in 48 hours the ship's going to be riding on the bottom of the ocean. I say, gee, I got to have a solution. I got to solve that problem for George Gordon. Well, listen, there are people in positions of authority like Captain Smith who could solve the problem for all 2,000 passengers on the Titanic by slowing down and heading south. And we're not going to set a new transatlantic record on this trip, but there will be more trips to be made in the future. But little guys like you and me, you know, I can't control the ship. The ship of state is being controlled by the politicians and the multinational oil companies. I'm just a passenger on here like you and everybody else. But I see a problem, and I'm saying to myself, you've got all these greenies out here, environmentalists and other wackos, environmental wackos, that's what old Rush Limbaugh calls them, who are calling attention to the problems like Al Gore without a solution. Problems without solutions. You don't need to know about that. If you don't have a solution to the problem, why do you need to know about it? What are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? Now, I'm going to do something about it. I'm prepared for $50 a gallon gasoline, and I'm going to maintain my standard of living on $50 a gallon gasoline. and I'm going to do something about this thing of electric power. You know, when the price of oil gets up to where gasoline is $50 a gallon, don't you think the price of electricity is going to be a little higher than it is today? And if that's the case, then I probably am not going to be able to afford it. So my standard of living is going to drop precipitously. So if I'm going to have electricity, I guess I better start preparing for it. I better do something about it. And I don't care whether you live in downtown Cleveland, nor you live out here on the plains of Montana. All of us have the same problem. And you've got a standard of living that you want to maintain. I don't think government can solve the problem for us, and I don't think government even ought to get involved in it. But I don't make these policies that governments follow. And I'm not going to do anything about the price of oil or natural gas or the price of coal. I'm going to tell you a little story here. When I built a house, a remodeled house up in Boise, Idaho, and I had a coal furnace in the basement. I was from California, so I'd never seen coal before in my life. So I just went on and bought coal and stuck it in there. And I thought it was a pretty novel heat plant. Gave us good heat. Took about two tons of coal, and I think the coal was $85 or $90 a ton. So for under $200 a year, I could heat my house with coal. Well, you know, coal has some work to it. You gotta shovel it and you gotta move it around, and it's dirty when you touch it and one thing and another, and people complain and they like natural gas better. Well, natural gas was at least competitive with and probably cheaper than the coal. So I converted. I threw the old coal furnace out and put in natural gas furnace. And of course, I was in the real estate business, so I'm just interested in selling what the people want, and they don't want coal, they want natural gas. But there wasn't any reason to turn that house over. You know, ecologically, I don't know, maybe the greenies would tell you you're polluting the air, but now you're using natural gas in that house. And I suppose that natural gas is as good as any, better than most. But if we need natural gas to run our industries and other sources, doesn't it make more sense than to let the marketplace run the price of natural gas up to where it's got a natural ceiling and it freezes out people that could be using coal or something else to heat their houses? Again, as long as the natural gas and the oil are as cheap as they are today, there isn't going to be any conservation of oil. People are buying these Humvees now at $40,000, $50,000 a copy, and they only get 10 miles to the gallon. Well, that's the marketplace. Because the price of oil today, measured in gold, is $2.73 a barrel, which is what it was in 1907. Nobody's going to change. We're going to burn more of the stuff, not less. Now, let's take a look at some sources of information and take a look at some short explanations. That's a pretty good article. Year when the global oil supply first fails to meet global demand is about 2009, about 5 years from now. The year when the global oil supply first fails to meet global demand, about 2009. Conventional, easy to extract oil peaks around 2005, but non-conventional will fail about 2009. See the International Energy Agency tables. And they got some numbers and sources and one thing and another. And it comes from Colin J. Campbell and Jean H. LaHare at the end of 1999. They have each worked in the oil industry for more than 40 years. Okay, so we got a couple guys that wrote a book, been working in the industry for 40 years, and there's their take on it. Campbell, completing his PhD in geology at the University of Oxford. He worked for Texaco as an exploration geologist and then at Amoco as chief geologist for Ecuador. His decade-long study of global oil production trends has led to two books and numerous papers. He worked on behalf of the Petro Consultants of Geneva, a consultancy whose database is the most comprehensive available for data on oil resources that exists outside of continental North America and is used as a Bible by all international oil companies. The IEA is an international body set up under treaty by OECD, including the United States, to deal specifically with the issue of oil depletion. A conservative organization, it has, however, indirectly confirmed Campbell's assessment in its World Energy Outlook in 1998. And then it's got their webpage and so on. LaHare's early work on seismic refraction surveys contributed to the discovery of Africa's largest oil field. At Total, a French oil company, LaHare supervised exploration techniques worldwide. The rate of decline of global oil supply is 3% a year from 2009 on. So from an address by Dr. Colin Campbell at the British House of Commons on July the 17th, 1999, you can read the address and accompanying PowerPoint slideshow at, and then there's a webpage here. Also, Dr. William Rees' article in Globe and Mail, the Canadian national newspaper, 29 March 2000, said, quote, several recent studies project world oil production to peak by 2013 or sooner, possibly as soon as 2007. Even the necessarily conservative International Energy Agency in its World Energy Outlook, 1998, occurred for the first time that global output could top out between 2009 and 2012 and decline rapidly thereafter. IEA data project a nearly 20% shortfall of supply relative to demand by 2020. that will have to be made up from unidentified unconventional sources. For example, known oil sand deposits have already been taken into account. And William E. Rees is an ecological economist and professor in the University of British Columbia School of Community and Regional Planning. You know, I got to stop here and point something out. There's only about 30 million of you Canadians, and you've got 1.6 trillion barrels of oil sitting up there in Alberta in your tar sands, and I think you're producing around 250,000 barrels a day out of that today, or something on that order. I forgot exactly, but you know, Canada could be energy independent just off of those tar sands, probably for, you know, 100 or 200 years. But you're exporting that, you're selling that to the United States. And what are you people up in Canada getting for your oil, your non-renewable inventory? You are getting worthless United States bonds, papers, and commercial credit. In other words, we are taking from you Canadians your valuable hard goods, that is your oil, that you and your children's children could be using for 100 or 200 years into the future, and you're selling that to us, and you're getting paid nothing for it. And you're going to get less than nothing because we're going to default on all of those notes, all of those obligations that we have. Well, I don't know. You know, it's up to you. And if you want our worthless paper, you know, we're happy to give it to you. But it seems like to me that countries around the world, Venezuela, Nigeria, and other countries around the world that have this oil, selling it to us doesn't make any sense. Now, it makes all the sense in the world for we Americans to take your oil and give you nothing for it. Now, I can see all kinds of logic from our point of view in doing it. I can't see any logic in you people following that as national policy. Now, the duration of the decline is forever. You know, if oil is non-renewable, now I did an article, or I did a program that came from an ecological newsletter, I forgot what it was now, in which there's a theory out there, a belief, that oil doesn't come from dinosaurs, that it comes from deep down in the earth and comes up to the surface. I don't know if that's true or not. There are some indications that it may be true, and I did that story for you, and you can go back in the archive and pick out that story. I did it last week, I think it was. So it'd be around, be in the month of October 2004, I believe, during the series on peak oil. Listen. I'm with you. I'm saying here that oil is probably going to run out. We're going to reach a point in time when we're going to have real market realities. We're going to have a shortage. And I'm taking action for the Gordon family. That's why we heat with wood rather than oil. And if I could, I would heat with coal. Now, coal is always a viable solution, but I've got so much wood here, I don't see any need to make any big change, and we kind of like our wood heat. It's more work, no doubt about it, but I save $1,200 a year right now heating with wood, so I'm going to keep right on doing it. Now, if you're living in downtown Los Angeles, that may not be an option for you. You know, if you're living in downtown Cleveland, Ohio, maybe that's not your option in your house or in your apartment. Maybe you should be thinking about, you know, if you're riding on the Titanic, maybe you should be thinking about a way to save yourself out of Cleveland or out of Chicago. Have you entertained that thought? You know, these cities may not be too livable if the price of electricity doubles, quadruples, or sextuples. And maybe if the power goes off, I mean, just take a look at these people living in Baghdad, where they don't have running water half the time and they don't have electricity half the time. I mean, you know, that's coming to the United States. Now, we're just a short ways behind the Argentines in our defaults. How that's going to shake out is going to be pretty traumatic for Americans. Pretty traumatic. Now, they go on to tell us a little bit more on this duration is forever. Chevron Learning Center geologists generally agree that crude oil was formed over millions of years from the remains of tiny aquatic plants and animals that lived in ancient seas. And then they've got a webpage here, chevron.com. Also, most North Sea and Middle East oil was formed 140 million years ago. Now, that's more evolutionary philosophy. I think that if we took a look in the scripture, I think that we'd find that these time frames and evolutionary concepts actually don't help us or aid us in the problem that we face. Now, I'm sure that God gave us plenty, and there's plenty here, but I'm not sure that we're dressing and keeping the garden. The ecologists do have some good points. They just don't have any solutions, or if they've got solutions, I haven't seen any. So if any of you greenies or ecologists out there have solutions, I mean real solutions that have economic meaning. I mean, I read that to you on peak oil, and biodiesel. If you people believe that we're going to weather this storm on biodiesel and wind generation, I mean, you know, you've got your head in the proverbial dark place. It's so far up your rectal region that your ears can't wiggle. I mean, that's just where reality's at. That isn't going to happen. And then tearing down your hydroelectric dams is just going to make matters worse. Now, it's true, you've got some problems with the salmon, but that needs to be solved. I mean, let's get busy and let's solve the salmon problem, and let's solve, but let's not tear the dams down. Can we have fish and dams? The ecologists tell you, no, you've got to have fish or dams, and we're in favor of fish. And then the other side says, well, we're in favor of electricity, and to hell with the fish. And I reject both camps. I say, I want the dams, I want electricity, and I want fish, and then I want to get the government the hell out of the marketplace. And I think we'll all live happily ever after. But then, you know, that's just my opinion. Now, barrels consumed globally per year as of 1999. Barrels consumed are more than 22 billion a year in 1999. That's about 2 billion barrels per month. Barrels consuming, you will always run into the problem of what is being measured. Conventional oil only or all liquids, also with Discovery. Excluding deep water, there is a long downward trend of Discovery to about 6 GBA now, save for a spike this year of about 15 to 20 with the Caspian Sea cache again, East Discovery. With the deep water apart from the spike, it is about 11 GB with the deep water trend still rising. Colin Campbell, private email, June 2000. Now, they're discovering some pretty significant oil finds out here in deep water, 10, 12, 15,000 feet deep. I mean, they're getting wells out there that produce 15,000 barrels a day. And I don't know quite why, and that's where this story came in, that maybe these wells are being refurbished from deep water, deep within the earth reservoirs. I'll leave all of that out, because if that's true, well, then maybe we won't run out of oil, and all of this is just whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Again, like Y2K, I prepared for Y2K and it didn't materialize. So what? I mean, it's better than buying insurance and then not dying. I still have all the supplies that I bought up during Y2K, didn't lose a thing. Hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we talk to the police or government agents. That is, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law. And it says, all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. It's a classic. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? And he said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Listen to the second judge. Another classic. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. And he said that in Belknap versus United States. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice, wouldn't I? Now, listen to this third judge. Here's another classic. He says, quote, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on the email, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the oil crash and you. An article sent in here by a listener named Tate. Is that Tate? It was an odd name. Let me look it up. Yep, T-A-T-E, Tate. Thank you so much, Tate, for sending this in. Good information. I'm giving you the statistics. I'm telling you that, in my view, we need a solution. And I don't hear anybody telling me what the solution is. The presidential candidates aren't even talking about peak oil. And I mentioned to you a little earlier that they're not talking about the solution to the coal or the high sulfur content of coal and acid rain in the East. They want your votes, and so they avoid talking about the issues that need talking about. And I guess that's because Americans have become totally socialistic. We expect government is going to solve every problem that comes up. Unfortunately, government not only doesn't solve the problems that come up, they create those problems, and they exacerbate the problems that they do try to solve, such as sex education in school. When I went to school, a pregnant girl in school was a rare commodity. Today, 10% of the high school graduating class is pregnant. Well, 10%, that's 10%, I guess, of the girls. Now, that's not a solution. That's exacerbating the problem. We started out with practically no problem. Now we've got a hell of a problem. And that's just one. I could sit here and cite those kinds of numbers and statistics to you until the cows come home. Peak oil is one of those problems that needs to be addressed by the marketplace. Marketplace. Let the marketplace alone. The price of oil will go to $4 a gallon. The problem is you people don't want to hear $4 a gallon oil. which is where it ought to be. Because today the price of oil is the same as it has been for 100 years, adjusted for inflation. There's never going to be any conservation of oil until the price doubles. And I mean the price doubles from 273 a barrel. Let's take 273 times 2, 546. Now, it just so happens that over in Europe, at least in Great Britain, the price of oil last time I checked was $5.80-some cents, $5.80 a gallon. $5.80 a gallon. Not a barrel, a gallon. $5.80. We're pushing $6 a gallon. Now, I told you that I could live here on my farm without any depreciation in my standard of living with $50 a gallon gas. $50 a gallon. And I think Americans ought to be preparing for that eventuality. They're not, and they're not going to, but then that's not my problem in life. I'm looking forward to my standard of living. I want to maintain my standard of living. When I flip the light switch, I want light. So I'm gonna spend a few bucks and put in an electric plant. And I'm not advertising, and I'm not advocating that you put in your own solar electric plant. It just so happens that now solar electric is now becoming competitive with the prices that are out there in the marketplace. Probably not for your home, but at least on a ranch, on a farm, or in a factory, where you're using a lot of it. It is here. We got to put out quite a bundle of money to put the thing in, but it'll pay for itself in 10 years, and that makes it economically viable. And so putting in a diesel generator isn't very economically viable. If we're running out of oil, and we're going to be running into a period where oil is going to be decreasing by 3% per year, hey, this is not the time to be building an infrastructure depending upon oil. This is the time to be weaning yourself from oil. So the environmentalists are correct. You know, we've got to wean ourselves from the oil, and I'm going to follow you environmentalists. God bless you. God, I'm glad you're out here fighting for the fish in the Columbia River. I'm just sorry that you don't have any solutions. You know, real, down-to-earth, viable economic solutions. I think there are some out there, and a few people could come up with some of those. Maybe we could elect Ralph Nader to implement them. Listen to this. Barrels of new oil discovered per year. 6 billion in 1999. Now, that's a startling statistic. That was amazing to me. 6 billion. Now, that's very significant because, you see, we're consuming about 24 billion barrels a year, but we're only discovering 6 billion. Uh-oh. Can you see the problem there, boys and girls? I mean, you don't have to be a math whiz to figure this out. We're consuming three times as much oil as we're finding. Now, if we could find 24 billion barrels of oil a year, that would be a year's supply of oil. And if we could find that every year that we do that, means that we're self-sufficient in oil, doesn't it? But if we can't find 24 billion barrels, then we have to tap into the 1 trillion barrels that we already know and are proven reserves. Now, here was the thing that Tate took exception with. He said, you know, that trillion barrels that you said that are out there, they're not there. Oh, I didn't know that. See, all I can do is rely upon the information that I receive, just like you and anybody else. You know, after all, I read it in the National Enquirer. What could be more reliable than that? Or I read it in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or the Washington Post or the National Geographic. Now, the National Geographic gets their numbers, or at least they were claiming that they were getting their numbers, from the Oil Institute. I don't know if it's the World or the American Oil Institute. I don't know. Are the oil companies inflating the number of barrels of oil that they think that they've got? I don't know. I can't tell you that. All I can do is report the facts as I see them. Now, this is from a book called The Coming Oil Crisis, written by the same fellow, Colin Campbell, based on the oil industry's biggest and most respected database. And it's described as the most extensive petroleum database in the world, covering E&P contracts, exploratory wells, development drilling, oil and gas fields, geological provinces, geophysical surveys, companies, installations, and cultural features. Senior industry geologists' views on Campbell and Lahaire's arguments are summarized in the Petroleum Review, printed in COPE, C-O-P-E, 1998. I don't know what COPE is, but I imagine it's a Petroleum Review. Well, Petroleum Review is probably the paper, and what is COPE, C-O-P-E? Maybe that's the author, published in 1998. Also, a comment by oil depletion researcher. Now, this is oil depletion researcher Brian Flay. There was general acceptance of the substance of their arguments that the bulk of the remaining discoveries will be in even and ever smaller fields within established provinces. But most thought 400 billion barrels might remain to be discovered. However, Campbell points out that it would take 35 years to find 210 billion barrels at present discovery rates. Okay, he's right. You see, if they're only discovering 6 billion barrels of oil a year, and we're consuming 24 billion, and even if we do have a trillion barrels proven reserves out there, that's a 50-year supply. Well, over the next 50 years, we're only going to find one-fourth of that amount of oil again. Let's try it out. 50 times 6 is 300 billion barrels. So we're only going to find 300 billion barrels over the next 50 years. But we're going to we're going to consume 24 billion barrels. So let's just divide 300 by 300 billion barrels divided by 6. That's a 50-year supply at 6, but that's just enough to supply the United States, not the whole world. So we're only going to have 25% of the amount of oil that we're going to consume over the next 50 years that we're going to find. We're going to replace a trillion barrels of oil over 50 years with 300 billion barrels, and that's what these people say is the most optimistic scenario. Now, that means that oil then being consumed at the rate of 3 gallons per person per day in the United States is going to come to an end, isn't it? So $50 a gallon gasoline, you know, in the lifetimes of some of you people out there may not be too far off. Now, of course, they were telling me this 50 years ago when I was a kid. And 50 years from now, they'll still be singing the same song. It's just that at some point in time, it's going to come to pass, isn't it? Because remember, we're consuming oil at double the rate that we are today, every 15 years. So while the world is consuming 22 billion barrels of oil a year today, it'll be 44 billion barrels of oil in 15 years with a growth rate of 5% a year. How long is that going to last? And then 15 years after that is 30 years from now, it'll go from 44 to 88 billion barrels a year. And then 15 years beyond that, it'll go from 88 to nearly 180. You know, you're pushing 200 billion barrels a year. With geometric progression like that and population growth, if you're going to maintain your standard of living, you've got to have more and more oil. And there's no more of it. Unless, of course, it's being produced deep down in the earth. In which case, then is it being produced and is it being replaced at that kind of consumption rate? It just doesn't seem very likely. And remember, the numbers that we're using are the numbers that we're using today. I'm not telling you something here that's ethereal or hypothetical. This is what they tell us that we're burning right now. Now he says, is there a lot more oil that is undiscovered? Well, 80% of the oil being produced today is coming from fields that were discovered before 1973. I didn't know that. 80% of the oil that's being produced today comes from fields that were discovered 25 years ago. In the 1990s, oil discoveries averaged about 7 billion barrels of oil a year, only one-third of usage. The discovery rate of multi-billion barrel fields has been declining since the 1940s, and that of giant 500 million barrel fields since the 1960s. So they call a 500 million barrel field a giant, and they call a 6 or a multi-billion barrel field, you know, I don't know what they call that, but they call it giant, 500 million barrels. Only 1/12 of a billion. Well, think of this. In the 1938 fields with more than 10 million barrels, it made up 19% of all new discoveries. But by 1948, that proportion had dropped to only 3%. Most oil fields are less than 10 million barrels. I didn't know that, see? When I heard that they had 6 billion barrels up there in that Arctic National Wilderness, well, compare 6 billion barrels with 500 million. That's a half a billion. That's only 1/12 of that amount of oil. These multi-billion barrel fields are rare finds. I didn't know that either. That's why I said earlier, you know, there used to be wildcatters, people that were out here poking holes in the ground looking for oil. And if they found it, they made a lot of money. You know, if you got a 10 million, just figure this, 10 million, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 times 50 is what? 10 times $50 a barrel, you'd have 500 million dollars. So if I could poke a hole in the ground and find 10 million barrels of oil, I'd have $500 million. That's quite a chunk of change, even in our depreciated 5-cent dollars. Well, there's probably a lot of those oil fields out there that are going undiscovered because the big oil companies are looking for billions of barrels, millions of barrels. They're not looking for, you know, 10 million barrels or a million barrels or 500,000 barrels. Shucks, folks. Even 500,000 barrels times 50 is $25 million. Nothing to sneeze at. Now, I suppose you could go out there and drill a well, you know, for $25 million. Now, why aren't we out here looking for all these little oil finds? It's because we can't get beyond the environmental impact statements. Now, going on here, the finding of new oil here, in 1948, the proportion had dropped to 3%. Most oil fields are less than 10 million barrels, and 10 million barrels will supply the United States with less than a day's worth of energy. We'd have to find 365 of these 10 million barrel fields every day here in the United States. 365 of those every year. Large oil fields make up a disproportionate part of the world's oil supply. The 10 largest oil fields contain a fifth of the world's oil reserves. 20 more bring the total to a third. 500 large fields contain two-thirds of the world's known oil. The remainder is distributed among 20,000 or more small oil fields. The fact that discoveries of large fields are getting rarer means only one thing. We're running out of new oil to find. So the 10 largest oil fields contain 20% of the world's oil reserves. That's Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, and Iraq. 20 more bring the total to a third. 500 large fields contain two-thirds of the known or the world's known oil. 500 fields around the world have two-thirds of it. So the remaining one-third of the oil in the world, the remainder, is distributed among 20,000 or more small oil fields. Well, I would say that we need 20, 40, 60, 80,000 more of these little small oil fields, which are not going to be discovered. Not going to be discovered because we're not looking for them. I say we need them. But I'll agree with the environmentalists. This concept of constantly building more and more automobiles to consume more and more gas, to burn up the world's available petroleum as fast as we can, is like having some dope addict over here with a bunch of money in his pocket and he's trying to snort up as much coke as he can buy. You know, ultimately his money's going to run out, isn't it? Now, the U.S. Geological Survey now comes out with absurdly exaggerated claims. They say the 724, I don't know what a GB is, but I guess it's a measurement of oil, is to be found between 1995 and 2025. And they are already short 100 GB 5 years into the study, but they still say, and Campbell, so said Colin Campbell in private email June 2000. So here's where Tate is saying that they're making unrealistic claims. The block graphs of oil field sizes are right here in the USA. They've got a graph in here that shows you the size of these oil fields. And he's right. If these numbers are correct, then the amount of oil that has been proven, discovered, is inflated, but I don't know by how much. What that means is we don't have a 50-year supply. That's what they told us we had. And according to these numbers, they're only finding oil at one-fourth the rate that we're consuming it. That doesn't sound very good. So again, we need a solution. And the solution is like riding on the Titanic and you're a passenger, just one out of 2,000 people on the ship. As I pointed out, the captain of the ship, maybe the officers and the crew of the ship, the owner of the ship, Bruce Inmay, he's on the ship. Any of these people are in a whole lot better position to solve this problem or to get a handle on it than are the members of the passengers. But we, the passengers, are the guys that are going to sink when this peak oil ship sinks. And so George Gordon has to find a solution to that problem. And so George Gordon said, okay, let me take it on. Let me see if I can find a solution. So I've solved my energy problem. I'm prepared for $50 a gallon gasoline. I heat my house with wood. I've got plenty of wood here, and I recommend to my students when they come here to subsistence and survival, that's one of my school, that's one of the problems that you have to solve. There are 64 of these life-threatening problems. They come from the Bible, by the way. They're problems that everybody's going to face whether you like them or not. It's like nuclear bomb war, you know. One of these days, somebody's going to come up with a suitcase nuke and torch it off in Chicago. One of these days, and I just saw this on the news last night, Iran just tested a missile. They say this missile will deliver a payload to southern Europe, Spain, France. Well, maybe they're talking more about Italy, Greece, Albania, maybe Yugoslavia. Now, remember, it's these Iranians that are developing nuclear weapons, and the commentator said a preemptive strike wouldn't work. Excuse me, boys and girls, but a preemptive strike worked when the Israelis knocked out the Iraqis nuclear power plant back in 1980. I don't know why it wouldn't work today, but I was informed on the news last night that that's no good. Now remember that the big blow-up in the world, spoken of as the Battle of Armageddon, pits the West against the East in Israel at the Battle of Armageddon at Megiddo. Now why do you suppose the greatest battle in the history of the world isn't going to be fought in Russia? Or maybe in Germany? Or maybe in the United States? Why is it going to be in the Middle East? Could it be over oil? Now, I reported to you the other day that the Chinese are buying oil just as fast as they can buy it. They want to put in a 30-day strategic supply. They've only got about 10 days. They're not only buying the oil with their foreign exchange that they got from the United States. They've got this worthless paper that they're getting from us. So they're converting the worthless paper into oil. They're buying the whole oil tankers. They don't have any place to store the oil. Their economy has grown so fast, they haven't got any place to store the oil. So they're buying the oil tankers and they're parking the oil tankers in their ports. That's panic buying. That's desperation buying. When you buy the whole oil tanker and then park it full of oil, that's desperation. Panic buying. I don't blame them. I've said before that I'd be surprised if we could get to the election before the economy collapses. It looks like we're going to make it. we're going to make it to the election before the economy collapses. James Turk said he thought that it would take less than 3 years to deflate the last 5 cents. Now, James Turk, an economist, I reported this from the Money Changer. Do you remember this? He said, the dollar has already collapsed from 1930 to 2000. It lost 95% of its value. Now, would you call that a collapse? He did. And he says the 5% that's left is going to catastrophically implode when, like the Argentines, we can't meet our payments and we default, which is right in the pipeline. Did you know we hit the national debt service limit? That's $7 trillion. And Congress isn't going to meet until November. So we're running on emergency money. Now, Congress, before they broke for the election, passed an emergency bill and said, well, we will fund everything but defense at the same level that we were funding it last year. Then they'll come back and work on the budget when they get back after the election. America is on emergency rations right now in our economy. Now, this guy comes along and says, and then we got peak oil coming right around the corner. Some people have said we've already reached it. Some people say it's coming in 2009, 10, 12, 14, something like that. And they've inflated the amount of reserves. That's what this report is telling us. Oil has hit $50 a barrel this year, which is the same price that it's been for the last 100 years. So nothing's changed there. Priced in gold, of course, not in Federal Reserve notes. In Federal Reserve notes, it's gone from $2.73 a barrel to $50 plus a barrel. In gold, it moved from $2.73 a barrel to $51.87 is $2.73 a barrel, adjusted for inflation with a 95% discount for the dollar over the last 70 years. All right. I'm about out of time, so I think we'll break off right about here. I'm on page 4. We'll take it up right here when we come back. Remember I said we need a solution to the peak oil problem. And so we're going to talk about solutions for individuals, and I'm giving you some of those solutions that I'm implementing right now. I'm preparing for peak oil. I'm preparing for the deflation of the American economy. And I suggest that my students do that, and you might as well think about it while you're at it. All right, we're just about out of time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to my website at georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I've got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.